The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And, you know, I get into the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and, you know, their long separation where they weren't talking for quite a long time. And then suddenly they became friends after really having a terrible relationship with each other. And I did ask President Trump, I asked him if he thinks he could ever be friends with any former president in the same way that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson became friends before they died. And he said, anything's possible. So I just think it's interesting to see if these fences can eventually be mended. And I think in Donald Trump's case, that's not going to happen just because there's been so much vitriol.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 20th, 2020. There may not be many laws governing how former presidents should interact with the current commander-in-chief, or with each other, or how the sitting president should treat his or her predecessors. But over time, we have developed a body of norms about how to do so appropriately. Donald Trump has, to put it mildly, changed expectations about the relationships that presidents, past and present, have with each other. I recently sat down in the Virtual Jungle studio to chat with Kate Anderson Brower, who has written Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump, describing these dynamics among the few people to know what it's actually like to be president. We talked about her interview with Donald Trump to get at his feelings towards his predecessors. We talked about the unwritten rules of the President's Club, and we even talked about what his post-presidency might look like. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 20th, Trump and His Predecessors, with Kate Anderson Brower. So, Kate, you got an interview with the President of the United States about a year ago, and you tell the story about how it didn't start the way you thought it would, because you'd been clear with the press secretary, I believe, about what the topic of the interview was, but was the president clear about what you were there for?
Well, a few times during the interview, he asked if I was talking about first ladies, because I've written a book about first ladies. And I think he probably had, because he watches a lot of cable, you know, he might have seen me on TV. And so he thought that that's what I was asking him about. And then I did mention in the interview this feud he's had with the Bush family. And a book had just revealed that Barbara Bush had said that the Trump presidency had, you know, really hurt her health, had a negative impact on her health. And so I asked him about that. And I think that's where the confusion was. But one of the most interesting things about interviewing President Trump was that the layers of people around him were so minimal compared to other presidents. I mean, as you know, it's very difficult to get through to any president,
right?
Former president or otherwise. But he just, you know, I just emailed Sarah Sanders and she said, what time, you know, do you have available? Which was kind of amazing to me, actually, and wonderful.
That's about as easy as it gets. And exactly. He did actually share with you some things that we'll get into as we walk through the topic here. So you are not there to talk about first ladies specifically. What was the topic you wanted to talk with him about, and why did you decide to investigate this issue?
Well, I've always been really interested in what happens after you leave the White House and the presidency. And, you know, I've written about the Nixons and after his humiliating resignation and what, you know, their time in California and what that was like and his kind of clawing his way back, trying to get sitting presidents to talk with him about foreign policy. And he ended up having a relationship with Bill Clinton when Clinton was in office. So I just was always interested in that. And then with the Trump presidency, you know, he's just such a norm-breaking president. And I wanted to get into how he has affected the President's Club, this group of living former presidents. At the time I started the book, George H.W. Bush was still alive. And, you know, how he's changed their relationships with each other and how they view him.
And you aren't the first person to write, of course, about the President's Club, but you are the first person to explicitly write about Trump in the context of that President's Club and the relationship that Trump has, or in many cases doesn't have, with his predecessors. So I'd like to walk through some of this, because this will be more about tradition than law, more about norms and understandings than legislation. But there has been a robust pattern that's built up over time around some unwritten rules about how former presidents operate. And I'd like to walk through each of those and have you explain the concept and maybe give an example for some of them as well to illustrate how former presidents in general have come to behave with one another and with the current occupant of the Oval Office. So let's start with your first unwritten rule of the President's Club: honor shared history. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the presidency is bigger than any one man or woman one day, and that there should be a sense of respect and even grudging admiration for the people who came before you. And I think that that has been the case for almost every president. And to be clear, there have always been rivalries, obviously. You have Theodore Roosevelt running against Taft, his chosen successor, as a third-party candidate. I mean, you know, there's a lot of bad blood over the years. But the point really that I chose to make in the book is that there's been nothing quite like this. And, you know, I get into the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and, you know, their long separation where they weren't talking for quite a long time. And then suddenly they became friends after really having a terrible relationship with each other. And I did ask President Trump, I asked him if he thinks he could ever be friends with any former president in the same way that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson became friends before they died. And he said, anything's possible. So I just think it's interesting to see if, you know, if these fences can eventually be mended. And I think in Donald Trump's case, that's not going to happen just because there's been so much vitriol and animosity out there.
I mean, history suggests it's possible. I mean, the tension between Adams and Jefferson was, I mean, to the point of, you know, Adams partisans claiming that Jefferson was sacrificing dogs on altars at his home and people assuming that John Adams was going to become a monarch. So if they can get over that, and even in the modern sense, of course, you've had bitter election fights between some presidents and some presidents who wouldn't even attend the other's inauguration within the last 100 years. And yet most of them end up coming around with at least some of their successors or predecessors to form relationships that work. So I think it is something about that shared history of only not quite a handful, but only a few dozen people know what it's like to be president.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Nixon said you cannot walk in those old rooms without feeling the heavy footsteps of those who have gone before you. And just the sense, the history in that house. And that's what I wanted to know. I mean, here I was sitting across from President Trump, and he's at the Resolute desk where so many decisions from, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis to 9/11, you know, have been come across the president's desk. And did that give him empathy? And I think that was the key thing I was looking for was, you know, did he have empathy for the men who came before him to see just how difficult this is? And I mean, the answer to that is no. And that was kind of, I guess, shouldn't be that surprising, right? But I think it's hard to hear.
Yeah. So a corollary to that, to honoring shared history, is another unwritten rule of the President's Club, which is respect the office and one another. Talk a little bit about how specifically that has evolved with some of the more recent former presidents, and then how Trump's view is different.
Well, I mean, as we were saying, I mean, there's this sense of reverence for each other that I think the presidents have. And it's very difficult to go from being the most powerful person in the world, arguably, right, and to suddenly not mattering that much anymore. And I know Alexander Hamilton was particularly worried about what would happen. He said that he was concerned that ex-presidents would wander around people like discontented ghosts, and that there should be something for them to do. You know, there was even a talk of a council of former presidents that should get together and advise the sitting president, which I could imagine would be an absolute nightmare for any sitting president, because they don't want constant input from the people who held the job before. But I think there was always a sense of, you know, what becomes of these men? And in that chapter or that subchapter, I talk about two examples of former presidents who went on to have these incredible careers. And so John Quincy Adams, of course, became a member of Congress, which is incredible to think of. And then William Howard Taft became a Supreme Court justice. And so Chief Justice. And to think of that ability to kind of have a life after the presidency, I thought was fascinating too.
Right. And the other aspect of that is that former presidents in general have learned from these unwritten rules to not try to make things more difficult for the current president. We'll go into more detail on that, but you had a great story about Bill Clinton actually reaching out to George W. Bush's national security advisor, Condi Rice, because he was going to be traveling to China. He was set to give, I think it was in Hong Kong, he was set to give a speech for a hefty sum of money, and he needed the money after the presidency. But it was right at the time when there was a plane that had gone down in China, and the Bush administration was trying to negotiate the release of servicemen who were with the plane. And tell me how that worked. Bill Clinton felt he had the need to reach out to the White House to say, you know, out of respect for the office and for the current president, I'm just letting you know we got an issue here, right?
Right. And I think that, you know, is there a message I should be delivering on behalf of the American government, too? Because there is still that protocol where you don't have somebody who, you know, when Nancy Pelosi travels abroad, for instance, she doesn't criticize President Trump, because there's a sense that there should be loyalty and a common bond among Americans. And I think that that translates also to former presidents. And Jimmy Carter is somebody who's stepped out of bounds many times and spoken his mind. And that has won him ostracism from the President's Club. And there's a lot of animosity there that they feel towards him. George H.W. Bush was very upset at former President Carter for his weighing in during his administration. And I think that we see Carter and Trump, although they are two totally different presidents, couldn't find a starker contrast, really. That's one thing they have in common, that they just do speak off the cuff in the way the other presidents do not.
Right. It's fascinating that there are so many norms and institutions that this president has changed or simply doesn't buy into. And yet some of these, like this one, avoiding criticizing a sitting president, Jimmy Carter broke that seal with several administrations before this one, and in a sense paved the way for Trump's attitude. But to Carter's credit, and I believe you note this, that he later did apologize, in particular to George W. Bush, for criticizing very bluntly the Iraq War, and specifically calling George W. Bush the worst presidency he'd ever seen. But he did apologize later for that, and Bush seems to have accepted that.
I think Bush said something like, "Oh, hush, it's fine." You know, I mean, and that says a lot about their relationship, that they could speak to each other that way. And Carter also, I know, feels still, I think, slightly guilty about what he said about Chelsea Clinton, because there was a time where he was critical of the Clintons' decision to send Chelsea to a private school. And, you know, the Carters famously sent Amy to public school in D.C. And so Carter lashed out at the Clintons and made reference to this decision that they had made to send Chelsea to private school. And I think this another part of the protocol here is that you don't bring the children of the presidents and first ladies into any beef that you have with them. So I think that's something he's regretted.
Right. One of the other rules you talk about is that current presidents should not fear asking for help from former presidents. And in fact, some interesting cases of this going back, even John Kennedy, who Dwight Eisenhower, his predecessor, was not much of a fan of. Kennedy swallowed his pride, called him after the Bay of Pigs and said, what are we going to do here? And got some real advice from him. How has this played out with the more recent presidents? And do you think that Trump is, in his remaining time in office, more likely to go down that road than he has been to date?
That's a great question. I don't think that President Trump is going to go down that road ever.
But he has once, didn't he? Reach out to some to Jimmy Carter, was it?
He did. He called Jimmy Carter at his house. Jimmy Carter was actually at a friend's house down in this tiny town in Plains, Georgia, where he lives. And he was at the buffet line there. And he got a phone call from President Trump to talk about China and foreign policy. And it's interesting. It was a couple weeks after my interview with President Trump. And in that interview, Trump indicated that he thought Carter had gotten a raw deal, that Carter wasn't given the respect he deserves. And I think he saw Carter as a fellow outsider, not accepted into this elite group of Obama, Bush, and Clinton, who kind of looked down their noses at him. And so I think there was some common bond there, but I can't see Trump, and we see this now with the pandemic, and he's been asked about this, reaching out to any former president. In fact, all we've seen is he's lashing out on Twitter when Bush posted that video about compassion. Trump lash out about that, which I thought was odd because it wasn't a direct attack on him, but I think he saw it that way. And then, of course, with President Obama, he's been basically saying that the swine flu and their inability to tackle that has something to do with this, or their mishandling of that has something to do with this pandemic. And so I think he's taking every opportunity to do the opposite of what JFK did.
And we'll come back later to some examples where previous presidents have used former presidents effectively for national security purposes. But some of the other unwritten rules, uniting in tragedy, as well as coming together to celebrate on occasion. That is, former presidents don't often hang out together. They don't socialize. They don't do a lot of public activities together. But they do come together in particularly good and bad times. Talk through that one a little bit.
Well, I think that, you know, again, this gets to the question of empathy and this feeling that, as you say, that they always realize that there are only a handful of them who know what this is like. And it's interesting to note that Richard Nixon is the most modern, you know, current president who had no living former presidents alive. After LBJ passed away, there was a period of time there where he had no former president to talk to, which I think is really interesting given Watergate. Would he have asked anybody else for advice? But I think that this sense that they come together to celebrate each other at presidential library openings and then also at funerals, it's a very important part of this camaraderie that they have. And I asked President Trump if he would go to President Obama's library opening. And he looked taken aback when I asked him the question, because I don't think he really thought of it. And he said, no, why would he? I don't think he'd invite me either. And that's kind of a surprising thing to hear, because, as you know, we are so used to seeing them all sitting there on the dais together, and it's this moment of unity. And President Trump would be such an odd fit in that group, very much like he was at George W. Bush's funeral, but probably even more so.
You're right, though. There is that precedent for it, which is Senator John McCain's funeral. There was no invitation extended to the president. And in a sense, it became about the president and about his non-attendance. Whereas even for some former presidents who don't get along personally or certainly didn't agree with each other's politics, they do have a habit of pulling together and saying, this is about something greater than how we feel about each other, such that the Bush family did invite the president to the funeral of Bush 41. He did attend. Now, you know, I was there and saw it. He came in right at the last minute. He sat with arms crossed. He often didn't participate in some of the service and then got out as quickly as he could afterwards. That's all true. But he did come, he did participate, and the other presidents lined up with him in that row. So maybe there's something to this, that he was willing to do that. It did not destroy the event in any way. It was odd, but it was not disruptive. And I don't know, does that establish a precedent that on some things, maybe he won't be, quote, a full member of the president's club, but for things like former presidential funerals, it would create more of an issue not to invite him than it would to have him there?
That's a good point. And when I talked to one of George W. Bush's top aides, he said, you know, as you say, the McCain funeral became all about Trump and Trump's absence. And so to include him, it makes much more sense to include him than not to. I think there is a difference between library openings and funerals. I think a celebration is less mandatory than kind of a somber event like a state funeral. So I can see that. I can see President Trump, for instance, and hopefully this doesn't happen anytime soon, but, President Carter's funeral at some point attending, because they also see each other as outsiders. So I know that he's on the guest list because I've talked to people close to Carter, and they, you know, he would certainly be invited to that funeral if there is a state funeral that's allowed anytime over the next couple of years because of this pandemic. But so I have thought a bit about that. But to your point about tragedy, another thing that I thought was how they unite in tragedy. Another thing that I was struck by is this relationship that Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower had, where they really were not close. But then when Kennedy was killed, they got together at Blair House and talked along with their wives. And that was another really poignant moment where I think there was this sense of humanity, and they're drawn together when a tragedy of that magnitude happens.
Absolutely. Some of the other unwritten rules: treasure the White House itself. And most presidents have made a big deal of this, whether it's their relationship with the staff in the residence or whether it is the physical plant of the White House. Talk about how Trump feels about the White House.
Well, you know, I have these sources from my book, The Residence, where I interviewed a lot of housekeepers and butlers who had worked in the White House. And when that Time magazine story came out a while ago, where Trump called the White House a dump, he has denied saying that. But I talked to some White House staff, a former florist who said, you know, this is just so terrible to hear. And it seems like a slap in the face for all the work that we do, because there is a staff there of about 100 people who keep the residence up beautifully. But it's obviously a smaller, I mean, the White House, as you know, is huge on screen, but it when you're actually there, it does not have the enormity and kind of the flashiness that I think Trump is used to. Mm-hmm. So, that I have interviewed people who recently retired from the White House and who worked when Trump was president. So these are housekeepers, a butler. And they say that he is actually very respectful. And not that I'm surprised by that, but if you look at his tweets, you know, there's so much anger there. But they say that if you see him in the residence, you know, having dinner with his family and his grandchildren on his lap, there's a whole different side to him that the public doesn't see. And it's as though he's putting on this performance for his voting base. And I think that some of the staff thinks, you know, this is really sad that we don't get to see that side of him.
And he has followed, to be fair, he has followed one norm in the White House, which is he chose not to gut the Oval Office and redo it in, you know, gold plating. He has chosen to do what other presidents do, which is move around the portraits of the president, move around some of the furniture, move around some of the busts and other artwork that's available to the presidents. Every president makes some of those choices, and Trump has done that. I believe the bust of Churchill was moved back in. I think Andrew Jackson was given a more prominent place. But That's not outside the norm of his predecessors, is it?
No. I mean, he has moved a lot of flags into the White House, into the Oval Office. That's one thing I was really struck by, is just the number of flags that are behind him, which I believe it's two or three times the number that other presidents have had. And I think that adds to kind of the pomp and, you know, ceremony that, that he thinks is important to be part of, you know, the view behind him, behind the Resolute desk. But you're right. I mean, he hasn't gutted the Oval Office. Part of that could also be he'd have to move out for a time. And no president wants to do that. No one wants to, they all want to work from the Oval Office. So redoing it would require, you know, something like Harry Truman did, where he moved to Blair House. I think he wants to stay there, work and work there.
Right. Another unwritten rule is that former presidents should give back, not all the time and not in the same ways. And some of them, of course, have done that individually. Jimmy Carter with his work with Habitat for Humanity, George W. Bush with his bike rides to raise money for veterans' causes. But on occasion, they will work together after major tragedies. And I think the highlight that comes to most people's mind is most recently the 2017 hurricanes that came in rapid succession. And you had the former presidents get together for a fundraiser. How did that come together? And do you think that that sets the stage for something in this pandemic era?
Well, I spoke with Gene Becker, who, as you know, was the chief of staff to George H.W. Bush after he left office. And she said that they had planned a 20th anniversary opening, you know, celebration of Bush 41's library and museum at Texas A&M. And so they were going to be doing this anyway. Mm-hmm. And then the hurricane struck and they decided to completely revamp the whole idea and invite the other presidents to come for this major fundraiser. And Donald Trump was part of that. He came in through, you know, there was a big monitor there and he spoke remotely. So it wasn't as though he was completely left off of that celebration. But I think that it was still a little bit awkward that he wasn't physically there with them. I think that he's chosen in this pandemic to make it clear that he's not going to ask for their help. I mean, in the way that Obama asked for George W. Bush and Clinton's help after the earthquake in Haiti. And then, of course, what we saw with Clinton and Bush 41 and the tsunamis, you know, what they did with that was hugely important. And I don't think that we're going to see that from President Trump.
Yeah, let's drill down on that a little more, because not all past presidents, but many of them have not just called upon predecessors for advice, or in some cases, like Clinton, simply gotten used to Richard Nixon writing advice in and then eventually taking advantage of it. But sometimes they have used former presidents as envoys. What comes to mind here is, you know, Jimmy Carter going to North Korea, Bill Clinton going to North Korea, as you mentioned, Clinton and Bush going to Haiti. Now, they are not official representatives of the U.S. government in most of those cases, but a president traveling overseas is still seen, whether they are a former president or a current one, any president traveling overseas is still a big deal for almost any country in the world. And that's a really good way, based on the relationships the predecessors have built, for a current president to get a private message through to foreign leaders. How have you seen that evolve? And what are some of the cases that stood out to you of relatively effective use of former presidents in that national security foreign policy realm?
Well, I think when Sadat was killed in 1981 and President Reagan sent Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Richard Nixon, and Rosalynn Carter went along for that trip as well, to the funeral in Cairo, because it was very close to when Reagan himself was almost assassinated. And so it was decided that it was too big of a risk to send him to Egypt for the funeral. And Sadat, of course, had been assassinated. And so it was a really volatile situation. And the idea that he would bring these former presidents together is a great example. And it is also the time when you see Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford really have this beginning of this wonderful friendship that they had together. And I interviewed President Carter about Gerald Ford, and he was a little emotional. You know, one of the great friendships of his life was with this man he ran against and who he effectively kicked out of office. Mm-hmm. And really they did not like each other at all, and it was very personal. Betty Ford and Rosalynn Carter didn't get along. The Fords were furious, and they were very upset when Carter won, and they didn't get to have another term in office because they never had a full term in office. So to see these two men come together, work together, you know, Gerald Ford would do things for the Carter Center. Jimmy Carter would help Gerald Ford with what he needed. And there was just a sense of, you know, here they were both bound by being really essentially one-term presidents too, that bound them together. So that was an example of former presidents being used in a really, I think, positive way.
And to be clear, most presidents during an election campaign don't like each other, and they say nasty things about each other, some more nasty than others. But I'm thinking here of 1992, when Bill Clinton was running against George H.W. Bush. And during the course of the campaign, both of them said some things that were very disparaging of the other. And it looked like one of those relationships, perhaps like Eisenhower and Kennedy or Nixon and Johnson, that you could never see these two getting along. And then a funny thing happened in the 20 years after that, to the point that Bill Clinton, some people joked only half jokingly, that he was almost like an adopted son to George and Barbara Bush. How did that evolve, and what effects does that have for presidents thinking about how they can get over this animosity during a campaign?
Well, right. I mean, you would never think that the two of them would have much in common. And, you know, separated by political party, generational differences, you have Bush, who was a hero during World War II. And then you have Clinton's very muddled Vietnam history. And I think it's fascinating that the two of them got along so well. I think it had to do with Clinton's reverence for Bush. I mean, when they went on these trips after the tsunami, they traveled together on the plane, and, you know, Clinton would always defer to Bush, you know, do you want to get on first? You should be the one with the bed. I'll sleep, you know, in the less comfortable circumstances on board the plane. And there was a sense of respect that they had for him. But I also think that Bush 41 was seen as somebody who politics were a part of his life, but they weren't his entire life. And you know that. I mean, I think he cared, was a big family man. Mm-hmm. And we see that even with his relationship with President Obama. And one of the things I thought was most interesting in this book was for me to report on was the fact that the last president to see Bush 41 was not his son. It was Barack Obama. Right. And to me, that's just fascinating to see this respect that Obama and I think Clinton obviously had for Bush 41, and the idea that the, you know, he gave them the time and space to make their own decisions, and he did not, you know, criticize them. He really tried hard not to criticize them, and I think he saw his time in office as a finite period of time, and he was going to leave and not weigh in publicly on their decisions.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned how Jimmy Carter broke one norm, one of the unwritten rules of the president's club, by criticizing his successors very directly. But there's another norm that has been undermined recently, and it's gotten much less attention. But every president since Franklin Roosevelt has had their presidential papers put into a presidential library, which is open to researchers. Obviously, there are some classified documents that do need to be processed, even for some presidents who are decades out of office, but essentially a research center to learn about the decision-making of the president, to learn about what the White House did during those years, to learn about the foundations for legal and policy judgments during previous administrations. But Barack Obama is doing something differently than having the presidential papers in a library that is run by the National Archives Administration. What is Obama doing instead?
Well, it's really controversial what he's doing. You have historians like Robert Caro saying this is a terrible change because these records should be available to researchers to go and physically touch. And the Obamas are digitizing everything. They're having a presidential center in Chicago. that will be almost like a recreation center. I think they're going to have, you know, places for kids to go and exercise. And like it's going to be a community center, essentially, and not the presidential library that we would know, which is usually, you know, a very kind of staid and quiet place to go where you have people like Robert Caro going through papers. And people in the Obama administration will say, well, there are no papers to go through, right? Everything's digital now anyway. So why not make this available to anybody around the world who wants to access it? It shouldn't be something you need to physically touch. And I think historians want to be able to physically touch things. And I think there's also concern about who's funding it. The fact that they're funding it themselves and the National Archives aren't as involved is an issue, because then can they have control, almost editorial control, over how they want to present his administration?
Do you think that sets the stage for Trump doing something similarly? You talked with him about the possibility of a presidential library and museum. How did he react?
Well, it was funny because he said, you know, he hadn't given it much thought, which I'm sure is not true. I mean, I'm sure he has thought about it. And he said that he was thinking, you know, if he did think about it, he would put it in, you know, Palm Beach or New York, and that he knows real estate better than anyone. So he'll figure out a beautiful place for it. And yeah. I mean, I think it's concerning. And I'm sure that the Obamas must have thought of this and decided that it wasn't worth changing their approach. But the idea that President Trump hasn't, you know, released his tax records and things like that, it's a sign that his presidential library could be heavily edited. Yes.
So there, one issue here, Kate, is that presidents generally learn in office that no one really understands what the job is like. And some of them have that sense going in, but several presidents have prominently said, I did not realize just how isolated, just how difficult in some cases it was. Mm-hmm. And some of the few people on the planet Earth who can't understand that are the former presidents. And therefore, you would think that a president could, on average, call up a former president and say, look, I need you to do something for me. You know, I need you to go to this country where we want to avoid a war, or we want to avoid a nuclear escalation. And I can't go because that would be, in a sense, giving them too much credit for what they've done already. But if you can go and you're not a member of the government, but I know you're going and you know that I know you're going and they know that there must be something going, maybe that can break this logjam. And that's happened in a few cases, but there's a danger here. And this is what happens with people who become president, who have a sense of ego and ambition, and they go overseas and they go rogue. That is, they don't follow the guidance that the sitting president has given them. Mm-hmm. Talk about whether it's, you know, Jimmy Carter in going to North Korea or Bill Clinton going to Haiti. Pick a case where a president has asked a predecessor to go overseas, or a predecessor has gone overseas but talked to the administration, and when it didn't go the way that the sitting president wanted it to?
Well, I think the best example of that is probably when Carter asked Clinton to send him to Haiti, and he was trying to persuade this military dictatorship to give up power to this democratically elected president, and it was a bit of a disaster, where eventually Clinton thought things weren't going well. And so he was actually sending the 82nd Airborne to invade. And like, this is a moment where Carter was rightfully very frustrated, because here he was putting his life on the line, you know, essentially, and, you know, there wasn't the communication. And I think there was a sense that Carter was overstepping. And we see this again and again with Jimmy Carter, to the point where the famous photo of the former presidents together with President Obama in the Oval Office right before he came into office, George W. Bush had orchestrated this meeting. You see Jimmy Carter off to the side, kind of sheepishly standing off to the side. And there was not a lot of love there for him. And I think that's a good example of it. And he, again, kept doing this, where there are a couple examples where Jimmy Carter would, before, and you know about security briefings, he would come back, and before he would even brief the president, before he even talked to President Clinton, he did a CNN interview.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a huge breach of protocol, and Clinton was understandably furious. So I think the sense that they're going rogue, and like you say, the ego of the sitting president is always huge, that you can't go on national television before you tell the president what happened during a foreign trip. That's just absurd.
There's a flip side to that too, which you touch on as well, that traditionally in the modern era, presidents have offered to their predecessors security briefings. That is, not the same president's daily brief that they receive on a daily basis, but certainly access to briefings before they go overseas, and sometimes regular packets of information, in some cases from the National Security Advisor himself. Did you find any evidence that Trump's feelings towards his predecessors have pushed him to cut this off and change that pattern?
You know, I don't know. I have talked to somebody who was very high level former Trump official who did a lot of briefings for the president. And there was, as you know, always a sense that President Trump didn't want to listen to things and wanted everything, to be on one page, and it was not a huge fan of reading. And in fact, that he would even physically turn away from a briefer at certain moments and ignore him. So I don't think there is a lot of curiosity there, which I think is a huge problem in this White House.
So let's wrap this up by looking at what all this says about Trump's post-presidency. I mean, you can have different models to look at here. One is a Harry Truman, who largely just went back home and had no public presence to speak of. You have another one, Gerald Ford, who, unlike most of his successors, was not wealthy before or after the presidency, and he decided to accept seats on corporate boards. And then you have others like George H.W. Bush, who, along with Barbara, raised something like $600 million for charity in his post-presidency and held no paying job. And in between, of course, a variety of things like the Clinton Foundation from Bill Clinton and Obama's very lucrative speaking circuit. How do you envision Trump's options after he leaves office?
I think Trump will be in a race to beat the Obamas. I mean, we have the Obamas could be the first billionaire former president and first lady, because I would couple her with him because her earning potential has been so huge. Their book deal was combined more than $60 million, and you saw how successful her memoir was. So I think that, money is very important to Trump. So he will want to race against that. But of course, Trump, I mean, just the reality of it, he is much, much older than Obama was, and therefore would have less time to do that. But I'm sure he'll write a memoir, and we'll see that. I think we'll see a lot of negativity continue, because that's really where he thrives. I don't think he's going to shut down his Twitter when he leaves office, whenever that will be.
So looking for your opinion on a couple of things here, based on the research you've done and what President Trump told you in his interview. Will Donald Trump follow George H.W. Bush in that Bush 41 is the only modern president not to write a full memoir after leaving office? Or will Trump be unable to resist the temptation to sell a lot of books?
Absolutely unable to resist the temptation. Look how often he talks about the art of the deal. I mean, this could be a bigger seller than that for sure. So I think he will write a book.
And then one of the most endearing traditions of the presidency and post-presidency, at least for the last several decades, has been the outgoing president leaving a personal note, one copy only, handwritten, in the drawer of the desk in the Oval Office for his successor to find and read, and then keeping the contents of that letter private until many years later. Obviously, Trump changed that a bit by leaking the contents of the letter that Barack Obama left for him some 7 or 8 months into his presidency. But do you think Donald Trump will leave a letter of support to his successor, whoever that ends up being?
I can actually see him leaving a letter for most likely would be Joe Biden if Trump isn't reelected. I could see him leaving a letter because that's something that's part of the presidency, and I think he very much wants to. He's very proud of being president. I mean, you see his he's got the monogram 45 on his shirt sleeves. You know, that's where he's the 45th president. So he's very proud of that. So I could see him leaving something short and pithy, nothing like what Obama left for him, which was the most incredible letter I think a former president has ever left, which was like begging for him to be civil and generous and think of people with less money and power than he has. I mean, that letter is really amazing, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to leave it there. Kate, this has been fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the podcast with your friends. Even if you're not seeing them, they should be hearing this. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Goat Rodeo Studios helped us with the production, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.